Thursday Night Tailgate, where the spotlight is always on the positive. Tune in Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time to hear your favorite NFL legends, players, and coaches sharing their stories. Now back to Chris and Bob.
I wouldn't joke about anything else that happened to you tonight.
And now back with us here on Thursday Night Tailgate is former Pro Bowl quarterback and TNT guest Hall of Famer, Jim Everett. Let me remind you quickly about Jimmy's background. He's from Emporia, Kansas, right there near Wichita and Topeka. He led El Dorado High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico to the state championship in 1980, playing both quarterback and safety. He played his college ball at Purdue, where he is the only quarterback in Purdue history to lead them to wins over Michigan, Notre Dame, and Ohio State in the same season. In 85, he led the NCAA in total offense. His senior year, he was awarded the Big Ten Medal of Honor in recognition of his athletic and academic achievements. He was a first-round draft pick, the number 3 overall selection by the Houston Oilers in 1986, shortly thereafter traded to the Rams, and he played in the NFL from 86 to 97 for the Rams, Saints, and Chargers. Over the course of his career, he threw for nearly 35,000 yards and 203 touchdowns. In 1999, he was inducted into the Purdue Athletics Hall of Fame. 2007, inducted into the Peach Bowl Hall of Fame. In 2015, he was inducted into our guest Hall of Fame, and we're eternally grateful to him, and we welcome him back to Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Jimmy, Chris, and Bob, how are you, my friend?
Hi, Jim.
Chris.
Hey, Bob. Hey, Chris. Hey, thanks for the intro. That's every time I hear that, you guys roll that thing out. I'm like, who is that guy? Anyway, being in your Hall of Fame is huge. Thanks, guys. I really like the work that you guys do. Talk about the positive. I mean, you talk about our society and different things we want to, you know, rip on each other, either be politics or foreigners or whatever it might be, race, whatever. You guys bring out the good. And I just want to tell your listeners that us as athletes certainly appreciate it. Really do.
Ah, we appreciate you saying that, Jim. That means a great deal to us, my friend.
Well,
so, Jim,
let me speak to the other guest real quick. Leroy Irvin, all right? So he was on the tail end of his career, but we had him and Jerry Gray as our corners. And Leroy was a fantastic guy. But I can tell you this. You know, you don't really know about someone until they're gone. And when Leroy had left or, you know, retired or, you know, however it goes, we so miss Leroy. And that's the kind of value you put on – you know, I know there was some other guys like Doug Smith, who was a center. When he left, we never replaced him. But we constantly tried to replace a corner. And it wasn't until, I think, the 1993 draft until we drafted Todd Light. So there was multiple years there we were searching for a corner like Leroy. We couldn't find him. And it wasn't until we found the great Todd Light, you know, and he brought his game in. But that's kind of value you look at guys. The general managers look at, go, you know, we need to replace this guy. And sometimes they're not easily replaced.
And, you know, Jim, take that a step further, right? When you have a guy like a Leroy, later on you mentioned Todd Light, but when you're in practice every day and you're going against a guy like Leroy trying to, you know, fit the ball into whether it was the Henry Ellard or Flipper Anderson or the other great wide receivers you played with, how much better did it make you and make the receivers to have to beat a guy like that day in and day out of practice?
Well, it made us really, really so much better. I mean, when you raise the bar and play against like that, I could imagine, you know, the same thing if you're going against Richard Sherman or Deion Sanders every day. You're going to anticipate, you know, getting the ball out earlier. You're going to do things at a different level. That's just what's required. I do want you know, that Henry Ellard and Leroy Irvin would kind of make deals together, not to embarrass each other during practice. But when we have younger guys like Flipper and Aaron Anderson and Aaron Cox, those guys would come in and say, oh, I don't care about the veteran. I'm just going to go run my route. And so Leroy would be like, so it was funny. But you got to realize we had the older version of Leroy, not the young, spry one, but he sure was competitive.
Jim, is kind of sticking on the defensive back position. The Rams have certainly done a bunch of shuffling with that this week. And after trading two more first-round picks away to get Jalen Ramsey and the things that they've done this week about, you know, the defensive back position, your thoughts on what you're watching the Rams do right now?
Well, let's go back before the Ramsey trade. You know, we had a cornerback named Marcus Peters who's pretty good. I mean, he really is pretty good, and I think he'll do fine for Baltimore. Tlaib was on our side. He just went on IR. It's unfortunate. He's more of a shutdown corner, but, you know, that's unfortunate he got hurt. So to go back to what Marcus Peters doing, and I want to talk to that because he's one of the guys that helped the community out so much. He's such a good spirit, it's not his fault he got traded. It's not his fault that he's not the shutdown tight corner that Wade's looking for. So he needs to be a little bit more in a zone scheme because he can jump and anticipate things a little bit, rather than be, more of the shutdown corner like Jalen Ramsey. So I think they each have their own talents. I just think that Jalen is more of what Wade Phillips is looking for at a corner. And of course, any defensive corner, a coordinator would want Jalen playing for him. And we're lucky that the Rams did it. Les Snead being able to throw some draft picks out and do this. And I mean, he's not afraid to take the bite of the apple. That's for sure.
So to that point, Jim, it seems like, and Bob and I were talking about this at the top of the show, it feels like the Rams are kind of shoving all their chips in. Right? I mean, they haven't had a first round pick the last 3 years. They're not going to have a first round pick unless they make another deal for 2 more years. It sort of feels like this Jalen Ramsey thing is the Rams putting it, we're all in now. And if they don't happen to win a Super Bowl, whether that's this year or probably next year, that maybe they might look back and think maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. I don't know. Is this a risky move for them?
I think there's part of risk. I think there's part of natural human ability that wants to be risk averse. There's a lot of general managers out there that wouldn't, frankly, have the guts to pull this trigger. I mean, really, just for job security. Because if it is, but you got to realize Los Angeles is in a position where we're going to be opening up in a brand new stadium next year. There's a lot of hype. There's a lot of things. Being 3-3 is not some place that they want to be. They could have easily been, maybe 4-2. We made a kick, this and that. So I think they're a good football team, and I don't want to get away from that. I think that there's some issues with the offensive line that needs to get ironed out. I don't think this team is far, far away. I just think that being 3-3 is a record that makes them do a wake-up call. So, is it going to be risky? I guess we get to look back over the years and say, gosh, we've been void of talent for 5 or 6 years. No wonder they're in the cellar. I don't know if that's how it works out. Washington Redskins did it. I think it was in the late 60s or 70s, whatever, and they worked out pretty good. I think what Les is doing is saying, you know what? I think I can find good talent in the second, third, and fourth round. I think salary cap-wise, it makes sense with second and third and fourth rounders. You just got to hit on those guys. So, I think he's saying, you know what? I think I can find these guys. Let me just get the superstars to hold down the spot because you look at it, you give 2 first-round picks for a Jalen Ramsey. You're going to have one to find the guy. And one's already the guarantee. A lot of the first-round picks, Chris and Bob, are frankly 50-50 chances. Is the guy going to hit or is he going to be
right.
So,
right.
Yeah, as part of it, like, hey, I'm going to just guarantee myself that I know I'm going to get the best. But that's part of a philosophy that not everyone has.
Bob, questions for Jim?
Great to speak with you as always, Jim. I wanted to ask you about John Robinson, who you played most of your career in Los Angeles under. I think a lot of people, when he came out of college, Jim, they thought he was just a college coach that might do good in the NFL. He ended up 9 years. I think he won 10 or more games 5 times. Very good coach. How was he as far as an offensive mind, and what did he do for you?
Well, John's expertise, and every coach, every head coach, has their own expertise. If you were to look at McVay, maybe it's offense. But I tell you what, you can put Sean McVay in any meeting room and he's going to know every position. But going to John Robinson, his bread and butter was about the running game. And that was, he knew how to run the ball with the Charlie Whites of the world. At USC when he was running with Marcus Allen, he knew the running game probably better than anyone I know. And he brought that to the NFL. Of course, he had this guy named Eric Dickerson at the time that didn't do that. And he even resurrected a Greg Bell into a great runner. So with that focus, I think we knew our running game was going to go in. I think when I came there, they didn't really have a passing game. and that was new, and that's why we brought Ernie Zampezi. But going back to John Robinson, probably one of the best storytellers I've ever met in my life. I mean, he just captivated you. And the things that he would say would be at a different level. And then you'd finally get it. You're like, oh, I get it. And he would have these different sayings and different things went through. He was a pleasure. The other part about it is he treated us like men. There's other coaches I've been around that treat you like boys and that you have all these different rules. You got to act almost robotic. Not with John. John would be, you know what you need to get done, get it done. He was into detail, don't get me wrong, but he would say, I don't care if you do it your own way, just get it done. So it let a lot more autonomy come out in the person. I think where John eventually, at the end of the career, of his NFL career, I really wish John would have had the opportunity to pick personnel. And I think that was the downfall in Los Angeles. You know, we're talking about Les Snead and his stuff that he's doing, by picking Jalen Ramsey, but I'd be able to pick, you know. But Les Snead picks Cooper Kupp, who exactly is what Sean McVay wants. I think if John Robinson had a personnel guy like Les Snead, I think John Robinson would still be coaching. But he didn't, and he didn't get a pick. For example, in one particular draft after we traded Eric Dickerson, which John did not want to do. But where we had these draft picks, first pick in the draft, the general manager picked Gaston Green. And our next pick was Aaron Cox. Both players you probably have never heard of. If you went with the coaching staff, our first pick would have been Michael Irving. And our second pick later in the draft would have been Thurman Thomas, because that's who John Robinson wanted.
Wow.
So
wow.
That's the type of things that's going on behind the scene that a lot of fans don't get to see. Is the GM on the same page as the coach? Is the coach going to get let go? So the GM makes all the personnel positions. Like, for example, Kevin Green, one of the best 3-4 outside linebackers ever. John Robinson late in the career was forced to take on Jeff Fisher as his defensive coordinator. Well, Jeff Fisher is a 4-3 Chicago guy. So they try to make Kevin Green a defensive end. He gets hurt. So the idea is, you know, Kevin's a 3-4 linebacker. So he ends up going to Pittsburgh, ends up going to Carolina, ends up going to Hall of Fame. He's just that good. But in a system where John, at the time, was forced to fire Fritz Schirmer, the defensive coordinator, had to go to a 4-3, didn't have the personnel. And it basically was a setup for failure for him. So wow. I can tell these stories, but these are all the things that go on behind the scenes that maybe some of the fans don't see. Maybe, you know, some of the averages, but if you look at it, teams and personnel and draft picks all have to be coordinated together to be successful.
And Jim, you mentioned the quarterbacking of those early teams, especially your rookie year. You came in and Steve Dills and Steve Barkowski were on there. Of course, Barkowski was at the end, but you all kind of split it three ways as far as starting games. Looking back, was that a good thing? Were you able to learn from the veterans? Take us back to that rookie year.
Yeah, let me take you back. First of all, I didn't get traded to the Rams till game three. So I missed all preseason. I missed three games. Steve Barkowski was there. He was an Atlanta Falcon guy. They picked him up as a free agent. He was the starter. I showed up at game three. I'm watching at Philadelphia. And I'm watching my first NFL game on the sideline. I'm not going in. I'm just in a jersey. And I watch Andre Waters take Steve Barkowski's knee out on a hit right to the knee. Cause that was legal back in the day. So Steve Barkowski had those first three games. He's injured. He's out. His basically career ending. Steve Dills comes in. John Robinson says, Jim, you've got 6-7 weeks to learn. Steve Dills gets the start. And then, you know, the fans are wanting me in because we're kind of lackluster on offense. And, you know, I come in and I finish out the year. So that's kind of how the rookie year went. But it was kind of amazing being at my first game that I ever showed up to. You know, I watched one of the, God rest his soul, Andre Waters. But, man, he used to have some dirty shots. They used to call him Dirty Waters, by the way. For a good reason.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
I think if Goodell had his way, he would have been fine, like, I don't know. I don't think there's enough money to find that guy. It was pretty hard for.
So Jim, I mean, you talk about all the behind-the-scenes stuff that we don't know about, and that's the story you just told is remarkable about how that would have changed NFL history had those moves that John Robinson wanted to do had come to fruition. I mean, everything about the NFL changes. The history of the Buffalo Bills changes. I mean, everything goes a different direction.
I think when you see certain teams, and this is what I would want to leave for your listeners, is you've got a front office, you've got an owner, and then you have a general manager, and you've got coaching staff. And if they're not all on the exact same level, and they're communicating, and one of the best things I see about what the Los Angeles Rams have done is Kevin Dimoff, you know, Jeff Fisher was there with Les Snead. Les was making picks that Jeff Fisher wanted. And even though they didn't work out, does the blame fall on Les or does it fall on Jeff? Well, as soon as they hired Sean McVay, it was awesome. They spent hours together. They were like best buddies, but they were talking philosophy. What do I want for my 7 technique? What do I want for my 1 technique? What do I want? What am I looking for? So that when they're out there looking for the draft picks, that they're actually picking guys that either Wade Phillips wants to embrace. He might not be the best athlete as opposed to somebody that, but they're the best guy for the system. The San Francisco 49ers did it years ago. The Patriots are doing it now. You can draft great athletes, but if they don't fit what you're trying to do, then it's a waste of time. Look at Cleveland Browns with all the different coaching changes they have. You can't tell me that the guys in that system are perfect for that system because the system was changing annually. I remember Bernie Kosar telling me, I had 8 offensive coordinators in 8 years. I mean,
wow.
So you look at Tom Brady, who's been there 17 years running the same system. That's not fair because that doesn't really happen to anybody else except for him. You know, so those are the types of things that look at behind the scenes is that when a head coach takes a job, does he have personnel say? Does he have the ability to say, hey, I want to get my guys in? Or am I just have to play with what the hand dealt, you know, given to you? And sometimes if you're a poker player, you know, some of the hands dealt to you aren't very good.
So, Jim, as you mentioned, you talk about the Cleveland Browns and personnel, right? If you get all these shiny toys, the Odell Beckhams and, you know, all the different free agents and the trades that they made and all the names they brought in, and boy, they sure appeared to win the offseason. But to your point, just because you bring in big name free agents doesn't mean they're going to fit into the system that the coaching staff wants to run. And then it feels like, based on what you've just said, all that just went to waste. Is that what we're seeing in Cleveland?
Well, everyone's a fingerprint. So, I mean, I wouldn't have to say something general for what I'm trying to describe as a world championship building system on how one organization builds players to another. I think the Cleveland issue, if we want to be direct, is directly related to the offensive line. Basically, all they could do is RPOs. Read pass options, because you're not going to get more than 2.6 seconds to throw the ball. And God bless Baker, but basically when you're running run pass options, the RPOs, you're basically, I'm going to give the ball, or I'm going to look up and throw it to that guy. So you're really not developing full read thing into Baker, and it's kind of, you know, I see him with his progressions and this and that, and it gets a little bit out of hand, but they have to run the RPO because they have such a liability up front. And I don't know how else to describe it. I think they can win some games, don't get me wrong, because they do have some good talent. But I, at some point in time, they have to address those tackles, and Trent Williams makes too much sense for me.
And Jimmy talked about the new stadium you guys are building out there in L.A., and it's certainly going to, I'm sure, be great for the Rams. Your thoughts on the Chargers? Obviously, you know I'm a huge Steelers fan, so I'm watching that game on Sunday night, and then in the little soccer stadium that they're playing in right now, I mean, it might as well have been a Steeler home game. Is that ever going to be a team that the city embraces?
Well, it's really tough. I think of all the different teams that could be in LA, and the mix probably should have been Raiders and Rams. I mean,
yep.
I'm not saying the NFL got it wrong, but the Raiders happen to be in Las Vegas, but the Chargers could be in Las Vegas and no one would really matter. It's unfortunate because the San Diego Chargers have an owner that's different than Stan Kroenke. Stan Kroenke right now is in the middle of building an almost $6 billion stadium, self-financed. That doesn't happen. I don't know. $6 billion is like huge. And I actually toured it just last week. And it's phenomenal. Phenomenal. I mean, it's built. I mean, all the earthquake-proof stuff. The stadium's different than the top is different. All the different areas. It's going to be the eighth wonder of the world. I was just amazed. They're raising the roof on it right now. It's really cool. But, that's different. The question you're asking me is Chargers. Now, I think there was a mistake. And I think the mistake was, I think they should have left the San Diego Charger name in San Diego. And if there ever becomes a franchise again, let that be. Because I think Los Angeles will embrace a new team. And they probably need a new owner. And I'll just be straight up. I think a guy like Ballmer or another LA-based guy that buys his team and runs his team here, I think would have much better chance than some of the baggage that Spanos brought. But, hey, who am I?
Bob, one more for Jim before we let him go.
Jim, I want to get your opinion, speaking of owners, for your time in Los Angeles, Georgia Frontier. I mean, she was there forever, took over from Rosenblum, and had control of that team even after moving into St. Louis until about 10 years ago when she passed away. Give us your memories of her, your dealings with her. Do you consider her a very good businesswoman, and did she surround herself with good people?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you this, and I was at her funeral. I love Georgia Frontier. I loved her for who she was as a person, who she was as a female owner, and I think there's a lot of value to that as far as some of the young women in our society being able to look up and say, it's not just a man's world. And I thought she did a really good job. One of the best things that she did is she surrounded herself with good talent, and she surrounded herself with John Shaw, and he's the guy that orchestrated this. Now, I don't think moving from L.A. to St. Louis had so much to do with the fan base, but had more to do with her making more money. You know, if you were a plumber making $100,000 and you could go down to the next city over and make $200,000, you're moving. I mean, it's just natural stuff. That's what St. Louis brought to them. They brought them another $15 million annually, another $5 million for here to that. And she was, believe it or not, at a point where, you know, he didn't need any more debt on the club because it would have been a forced sell. And they weren't going to build a stadium here in California. So, you know, I think that she was smart to do what she had to do. She increased the value of her franchise. She ended up selling it to Stan Kroenke, who was very wealthy and a Missouri guy base. Yet it was Stan Kroenke that brings it back to L.A. It's just an amazing circle. And all the history that's here at LA that was like their home. They came back. I mean, besides Oakland Raiders going from Oakland to LA back to Oakland, that stuff doesn't happen very often. I'll always respect Georgia Frontier, but who she was, I don't think you're looking at a Harvard Business School person, but you're looking at a person that cared about her employees and tried to do the right thing and had to do some of the things that were necessary to keep her, fiscally responsible.
Jim, one more for me before we let you go. And as I was looking through, seeing some of the things going on within the NFL itself, within the league, we see that Roger Goodell is, you know, back looking to add at least one more game to the schedule. We talked about for a long time that it was going to be 18 games. Now it looks like he and the NFLPA are trying to work it out for where it's 17 games. And maybe they take a preseason game or two off the slate, but if you look at those preseason games, they're probably not one starters are playing in anyway. So what that's going to hurt are the young guys trying to make a club. Your thoughts on adding a game or two and deleting a game or two from the preseason?
Well, I mean, from a player standpoint, we don't get paid any different if we play two preseason games or four preseason games. I mean, it's minimal. There's a lot of exposure, but I think you're looking at the Sean McVay's of the world. That's that thing. Now we need to really reevaluate what we're doing over these 4 weeks. Do we really want to expose our starters to injury? And I don't think they do. I think they could get a little bit more. Football's a rough sport. People are going to be injured even in practice. But let's have it a little bit more controlled so guys aren't. Maybe that 90th guy on the roster taking that cheat shot on your starter so he can make a splash won't happen. You know, take care of each other. And I think in some of the practice, see that happen. So I could see two preseason games fine. You know, what I think people have to realize is those four preseason games are direct money to the owner. So if anything, you're taking revenue away from them by taking those games away. But if you add a game, how that's going to, they're going to change all your records and all, you know, like going from NFL from 14 games to 16 games or 12 to 14, you know, now 17. So, you know, change all the records and stuff like that. But I think something needs to be done. I think one of the things that if I would recommend for Roger Goodell is I kind of like the NBA lottery on the draft. So where you have the last place gets the most balls in the deal and the next last place gets so many balls. And then you pull out of the hat who gets the draft picks. Because I think what happens with the season like this season we're seeing right now with Miami's, with Washington, where, you know, they're playing for the, you know, the number one pick for maybe Herbert or Teo or whatever. So I could see them kind of doing something with the draft so it, teams are less incentivized to tank.
Jim, before we let you go, remind our listeners how they can follow you on social media.
Well, thanks, Chris and Bob. Before we go, I just always want to say it's always a pleasure to be on here. I know maybe some of my thoughts are not always so mainstream, but anyway, I really appreciate the way the talk. If you really want some salty stuff, follow me on Twitter, Jim_Everett. and I say that with that caveat because I do like to be playful. I try to stay neutral on most of the stuff, but you know, if you got thin skin, don't follow me.
That's beautiful. Jimmy, we can't thank you enough, my friend. You're fantastic. We always love having you as part of the show. You're one of our all-time favorites. There's no question about that. Thank you for being generous with your time tonight.
Well, thanks. And I want you to know that on social media, I saw where Toy Cook finally admitted that in the Flipper Anderson 336-yard game record that he might have got beat once. He wouldn't admit over the years. He tried to throw Robert Massey under the bus all these years and finally goes, okay, yeah, I saw him film. I didn't get beat on that one. He finally admits. So I know he's on your show and you can bring it up. But
yes, he is.
To see after 33 years, reality has set in.
we'll pass that along to Toy the next time he comes on. I'm sure he'll appreciate that.
Thanks, man. Have a good night. Always enjoy it.
All right, Jim. Take care, my friend. See you, Jimmy. That's the great Jim Everett. It's always fun. It's always entertaining, and it's always informative, Bob. That's why he's a TNT Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he's, what a sense of humor, Chris. But when you hear him talk, he's such a great analyst of the game, too, and he. Not only did he play the game well, we know he's a Purdue graduate, but he's very schooled on the quarterback position in football in general. And, hey, you just smile every time he comes on.
Yes, we do. All right, when Bob and I come back on the other side of this quick station break, we'll be turning on our Thursday night tailgate spotlight on the positive. Here are two more great stories about guys out there making a positive impact on the community. We'll do that right after this quick ID.